And we are joined by an aviation celebrity bar none, I guess, Mr. Bert Rutan.
I would say legend would be
more. Oh, that's
more
a good word. We got to be careful. He won't be able to fit through the door when he leaves.
We barely fit now.
Yeah, right.
It's a skinny door.
I don't even see a door.
Well, we had a door, but they cut the budget.
Oh, there it is. Yeah. Okay.
Good morning, Bert. How are you?
Hello. I've been a lot better. Well, I've also been a lot worse.
Well, it's good that you made it here.
We understand that was an adventure in itself.
Oh, yeah.
Well,
yeah.
That's good. Bert, we have about a gazillion questions for you here. And one of the foremost questions, I saw a press release the other day. Spaceship Two had her first crew aboard, stayed aboard White Knight Two, and did a systems check while airborne. How did that go?
It went fine. Went fine. Yeah, we had like nearly 7-hour flight, and got the full card done, and pressing on down the test schedule.
That poor guy was in that thing for 7 hours straight?
Actually, there's two pilots in a Spaceship Two.
So there's a bathroom on there.
No.
Oh, darn.
No, these are not long flights.
You know,
even the commercial flights, they'll only be an hour and a half or two hours long at the most. So.
Oh, I'm sure that they had they had arrangements up there so that they had food, drink, and facilities.
We were kicking this around last night, and a question. How is it that you were able to do with such a small team what it took NASA years and thousands of people to do?
Well, probably the best example of what had been done was actually a combination NASA and Air Force program called the X-15. They started flying in 59 and finished in 69.
Something like
I think.
That.
Yeah, I did a 10-year program, research program. We were fortunate enough to be able to beat their altitude by a couple of miles, so that was neat to do. I've heard people say that, gee, NASA would have taken a long time to do that. I always think of, well, does NASA have an equivalent program to Spaceship One? And not really. The Mercury program, where they flew two suborbital flights with a Mercury Redstone rocket. That was primarily a initial test of the Mercury capsule, which was designed for orbital flying. So it was an ability to get the capsule up high, to give it enough time to test its maneuvering attitude control. They actually fired the retro rockets, where they didn't need to for suborbital, but they did it as a systems test. And then, of course, their parachute and water recovery. So I think a more comparable program would be the X-15.
I always thought, personally, that they did a lot of work there, and then they abandoned that approach for brute force power with a regular rocket.
Who abandoned what? Excuse me?
Well, when NASA decided to, when they went to the Mercury program, instead of doing an air launch like you're doing, they said, well, we're just going to use a big rocket and brute force horsepower to get it up there.
Well, of course, the Soviets had done that. They had used their ICBM for Gagarin's. And I think it was mainly a schedule decision. They had medium range and upcoming intercontinental range, you know, the Atlas missiles in work, and I think they clearly could fly a space flight using that off the shelf, as it were, military rockets, rather than the time it would take to develop a launch airplane.
Now, I mean, obviously, you said the Mercury was ultimate Mercury goal was orbital flight, your suborbital. The experts must have looked at you and said, you're going to build this thing out of composites, it'll never survive reentry. They must have thought you were a little out there on that one.
I agree with that statement, except for the word experts.
Ah.
You know, the reason that we use composites in the rocket motor
in the casing.
And the casing and in the throat and the nozzle, where you got 5,000 degree fire coming out the back, is if you built that out of metal, it would melt and it would open up and fail. So I don't understand why people would say that composites aren't suited for that. The best answer, though, is that suborbital, where you're not going, you're only going Mach 4, Mach 3.5 or Mach 4. You don't need thermal protection for that like you do at Mach 25. We could have flown the Spaceship One flights with no thermal protection at all. But we put about 14 pounds of protection on it, which was pretty much a mixture of phenolic microballoons and some high temp epoxy. It was nothing fancy at all, and all it does is it keeps that outer ply of composite structure from getting too hot to where it's damaged just on the outside ply.
Bert, I have to tell you, I'm extremely impressed by what you people do. But what really, you know, the end product is something. But what always fascinates me is, how do you come up with these ideas and how do you make it work? You know, there's a lot of things that you have to consider, even on a suborbital flight. I'd love to have been able to sit in on some of your conferences and see how you figured this all out.
Have you ever been to Mojave, California?
No, I haven't.
I'd love to go. We're from the other coast.
Yeah, well, you wouldn't ask that question at all if you had been there, because there's absolutely nothing else to do in Mojave.
Just design airplanes and do nothing.
Sorry about that. You just got to sit there and figure things out. One of the other things that Dave and I got to talking about last night was orbital flight. Now, you guys are just going up. You're taking a big hop. You're going up, and then you're coming right back down again.
I'm sure the idea has occurred to you, though. What's it going to take to go a little higher, stay up a little longer?
Well, let me just answer that by saying I wanted to do something that could make a difference, the biggest difference that I could, towards a path to allow me to have a resort hotel on orbit and to take a vacation on orbit in my lifetime, right? I mean, I kind of, when you get 65, you tend to look out there and you say, well, hey, what happens in 100 years is not important to me, but what happens within the next 40 years is real important. The problem is, I look back 40 years and I saw no progress at all towards the ability for the public to fly in space. The only progress there was the Soviets, whose space program was starving after the Soviet Union collapsed. They needed that $20 million per seat to fly a few billionaires. So that was the only progress in public access to space in 40 years, and it didn't involve any new hotel in orbit. It didn't involve any new spaceship. It was just, hey, there's a seat here and there, and we need a lot of money, so you can fill that seat instead of a government cosmonaut. So you can easily argue that we got to do something totally different in the next 40 years than we did the last 40 years. Totally different. Now, the difference, the most important difference, is going to be volume. And that is, we have proven by example, or by test and reality, we've proven over 40 years that you can't make any progress at all on the cost it takes to go to orbit or the risk. You know, the shuttle is more dangerous to fly to orbit than the stuff that we flew to orbit back in the 60s. It had a couple accidents and, you know, killed 14 people. And we didn't have any accidents in the stuff we flew in the 60s. And also, if you look at the standing army that it takes to support and fly and operate the shuttle, you know, clearly, it's by far the most expensive way to go to orbit. So there's no progress towards the public flying in 40 years. So I got to thinking, well, what has to happen? What has to happen is somehow have a system that is safe enough to fly the public and is affordable enough. And it doesn't matter much what you do with it, but you have to have competition, you have to have the safety, you have to have a very high volume and folks fighting for market share, and then the cost will dramatically come down. And once the cost dramatically come down, then public access will happen. I reasoned that I couldn't do that for orbital. Didn't know how. We still don't know how to go out and build something that's safe enough and affordable enough for the public right now. Nobody has figured that out. In other words, there's inventions or breakthroughs or things we don't know out there that have got to be discovered and known and built and tested and flown in order to have public access to orbit. But I knew that I could do it with suborbital space flying. Okay? And I knew that if we air launched and if we used this hybrid motor and if we used a feathered reentry and some other things that we were discovering, that we had enormous advantages over previous stuff. You know, for example, our maximum Q on reentry, the X-15, it's about 650 knots equivalent, and Spaceship One is about 75 knots.
That's a slow reentry.
Big difference.
Well,
there.
I mean, you're at 5 G's decelerating up at 100,000 feet, but you're only at 70 knots indicated.
Wow.
Okay, so you know there's some dramatic, and also the X-15, when Mike Adams had this instrumentation problem and got disoriented and got it a little crooked on reentry and it swapped ends and broke apart and he lost his life, we can't have that accident with a Spaceship One or Spaceship Two. The pilot, yeah, hell, he can have eat his lunch and reenter backwards and everybody will get home safe. So you know, we had these kind of breakthroughs that I know were generic and real. And I know that it would allow tens of thousands of people. In fact, I think Spaceship Two, if we move on and build 40 or 50 of them on schedule, that we'll fly 100,000 people the first 10 or 12 years of commercial ops. Now, having 100,000 people that are flown outside the atmosphere, as opposed to me working on trying to find a breakthrough on orbital ops, I'd be out there working like Elon Musk. I'd be spending a lot of money, and you know, he spent all the money he wanted to put into it. Now he's just a NASA contractor, really. And he hasn't made any progress. He's had success, which a lot of people didn't think he could do, and I applaud him for that. But he hasn't done anything unique compared to what you did in Gemini with a Titan, okay? So that's the big difference.
Well, we need to take a break, Bert, but we're going to come right back with another segment of Bert Rutan.